Welcome to the Capitol Record. This is your host, David Bahnsen, and I am thrilled to be doing an entire Capitol Record podcast today to talk about your favorite topic in the world, and that is monetary policy. I'm going to be bringing on today international economist, worked at the Department of Treasury for a long time, well-known author, wrote a book, Boom and Bust, Banking, the Causes and Cures of the Great Recession. David Beckworth will be our guest today. He is currently the Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason, and has been very focused on monetary policy throughout his academic and professional career. Someone that Ramesh Pinero at National Review turned me onto, and has a lot to say. And I have a feeling in our discussion today, we'll go into places that I'm going to agree and places I'm going to disagree. And yet really excited to have a conversation with such a highly regarded economist and monetary expert on topics that are near and dear to any who would, like we are all determined to do a Capitol Record, defend the system of free enterprise that we love. With that said, let me bring on our esteemed guest today. So with that said, welcome to yet another episode of the Capitol Record. And we are honored to once again have another first-time guest. It's amazing that there's still so many folks that we can bring on as first-time guests. I'm worried about when I have to start retapping, you know, last year's guest over and over. But I really believe that we're going to have a wonderful conversation today with today's Capitol Record guest, David Beckworth. David, welcome to the Capitol Record.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, the thing that I thought we'd dive in today is the subject of monetary policy. And right now, in the midst of Chairman Powell's reconfirmation hearings, with CPI reports coming out reflecting yet again expected very high level year-over-year price escalations, this topic isn't really going away. And I would love, just at a high level, for maybe you to tell the listening audience your background and sort of your general take on the issue of monetary policy.
Well, I am a former academic who now is in the think space world, although my work doesn't like to call itself a think space. We're a research center, technically. But all my work has been done on monetary policy, and it touches on capital markets, interest rates, bonds, things like that as well. But my general sense of where monetary policy is today, that it's going in the direction that it needs to go, it probably should have gone a little bit sooner. I do think we are seeing signs of policy that was very supportive in 2021, too supportive probably. With that said, you know, what the government did in 2020, I'm a little more sympathetic to. I think the alternative of massive income collapse, financial crisis like that is something we wanted to avoid. But I do think the Fed is going where it needs to go. It may need to be a little more aggressive moving forward.
Do you believe that the 2018 precedent of going into a form of quantitative tightening while raising interest rates simultaneously is likely to be repeated as they undo the 2020 policy framework?
That seems to be the case. And, you know, back then it created problems. I think you're alluding to this. We had the repo crisis in September 2019. And the, you know, one of the challenges of monetary policy during this time is that the Fed was in this ample reserve operating framework or floor operating system. And that's not my preferred framework. I prefer a smaller balance sheet for the Fed, a corridor system like the Bank of Canada has. But it's in this world, and it's a lot. There's a lot of unknowns. There's big balance sheets. There's big TGA balances from the Treasury. A lot of unknowns, and that could happen again. That'd be a concern going forward if the Fed did both balance sheet reduction and interest rate hikes. However, two things that are different this time. It's just the sheer size of the Fed's balance sheet. I think they can cut a lot without getting too close to hitting that wall. And secondly, they have the standing repo facility. I think the standing repo facility really changes the calculus of how much they can shrink the balance sheet before they run into problems.
Well, what are some of those problems? It seems that in 2018, it was credit markets revolting, spreads widening, and now in a very levered financial system that means more than it used to. And so my argument then was that it was sort of an issue of the Fed's making to some degree. They re-levered, they reflated the economy post-crisis quite successfully. And yet that left a lot of vulnerability to distress in credit markets. So then a high yield spread going to 500 wide was more problematic than it may have been before such reflation. Can this economy afford high yield spreads going back to where they were in the 2018 period?
I don't think so. And even though I said I think the Fed may need to be more aggressive, I have to couch that with it may not be able to do as many rate hikes as it likes and as the market is anticipating because of leverage, but also because the interest rate world we're in, rates have just trended down for so long. Magnitudes are very different, like you've alluded to before. One thing about 2018, I will also say that struck me is the Fed, if I remember correctly, was very eager to raise rates, even if that meant an inverted yield curve. There were several governors who were like, well, that's not that big of a deal. They weren't afraid to, invert the curve. In fact, there a t-shirt was created. We have the nerve to invert the curve, and I think, the same thing could happen now with different magnitudes. So I do think they were mindful. One maybe another point of hope or learning from that period is that they did quickly reverse themselves in 2019, right? Once they begin to see the damage they were doing and the limits to what they could do. And my hope is they learned from that experience.
How much of it do you think is stock market related? Is there a Fed, I was leaving high school in the early years of Greenspan's tenure at the Fed, and I've never lived through a Fed that had much tolerance for stock market distress. Can a Fed really afford a bear market in the stock market before they reverse course in desired rate policy?
Well, probably not. but I take a more benign view of that perspective, that tendency to keep asset prices on a stable path, and some would say elevated path. I think they're an important part of the economy. There's wealth effects. I mean, there's I think important channels that would be there, even if the Fed weren't acting. And I'd maybe go one further and say, I think a lot of where interest rates are today and therefore where asset prices are today are driven by fundamentals beyond the Fed's control. So yes, rates are low and yes, the Fed's a part of that approximately. But if you dig deeper, I think there's demographics and regulatory issues that are driving yields low as well. And if we worry about asset prices, worry about the stock market, and we think rates are a part of the story, we got to go to those deeper sources to deal with it.
And so let's talk about some of those deeper sources. You are echoing a view that my colleague at National Review, Ramesh Pinero, is articulated on this podcast before and written about, I think, very eloquently and cogently. And I wonder if there's a middle ground here. If the Fed were not engaged in interventions, and I think particularly of the long bond, where would the natural rate be? You refer to these natural forces. I assume you may be talking to some degree about global yields, about secular growth challenges, about globalization. Give us some examples of why bond yields with or without the Fed are below historical averages.
Well, there's a number of stories I can go through. And in the literature, this is called the safe asset shortage. And I know some listeners might find that incredulous. After $5 trillion of treasuries were added, how can there still be safe asset shortages? I would point to the 1.73% 10-year yield as we're recording this. Again, that begs the question of why is it so low relative to the size of the debt stock? But the fundamentals I'm looking at, demographics probably the first and most important one. The planet is aging. It simply is getting older. We see it in Europe, and really, we saw it first in Japan. I think Japan's been the harbinger for a lot of the stuff we're going through. They're losing about 500,000 people a year. I live near Nashville. Basically, they're losing in Nashville every year in population, and they age, low fertility rates. And we see that in Europe. We see that to a lesser extent in the U.S., and we even see that in China. you know, this powerhouse that's helped keep the economy going. And why does that matter? That means, as the population ages, people get more risk averse. So they're going to, on the margin, shift their portfolios to safer assets. They're also going to save more. If they live a longer life, they're going to save more. So that on balance increases the demand for fixed income, safe fixed income. There's also, you could tell the globalization story you alluded to, emerging markets. They've grown rapidly. They've been blessed because of globalization. And I'm happy for all the people that have come out of poverty, but their institutions haven't kept up with that growth. So they don't have the capacity, state capacity, to create safe stores of value. So they come to the US, to Switzerland, Germany. Another factor I think plays into this, maybe less so, but I think still important, is, this current generation, millennials, maybe even those younger than them, they've lived through two very severe recessions. And there's some research that shows if you go through a recession, you tend to be more risk averse throughout the rest of your life. So someone who's lived through two of them, on balance, a little more, a few more bonds in their portfolio. And then finally, I would say a lot of innovations, regulatory and just purely from the market. So, innovations, Dodd-Frank, Basel III, requiring banks to hold and financial firms to hold more safe assets, but also things like stable coins, growth of money market funds. Those things also require safe assets backing them. And I think all of these things have contributed to what we have seen. Probably the most surprising thing, if you take this view like I do, and I know Ramesh does as well, is that it looks like, again, I may be proved wrong in the next month or two, but it looks like it's still not fully satiated. Now, let me step back, and if you don't mind, and counter that. The one area where I think the Fed has played a role, and I think you can tell a fair story, is that its asset purchases have caused yields to go down, kind of as it's crept up the yield curve. As we saw this with the overnight reverse repo facility, rates were going in, so many reserves driving down the low end that it started to kind of creep up to the longer. And I think you could tell that story. But I'm not sure how important that is relative to the fundamentals.
So is your view, you bring up, four or five different categories of things that one could really cogently argue put downward pressure on bond yields. I wonder if your view would be in all of the above, that you don't see one primary causation, but the combination of those factors, mm-hmm. and maybe it's not academically discernible how to weight the causation. We just see all of those factors as plausible in playing some role.
Yeah, definitely.
So the Lacey Hunt camp, which I'll put my cards on the table, is the one I very heavily subscribe to, is I would say it's all of the above, as you've pointed out, with the primary being excessive government spending, Japan-like, that forces monetary policy to create a diminishing return. So the more you do to treat the problem, the more of the problem you get, and that we end up in a low growth expectation generationally that puts downward pressure on bond yields. And that let's say people out there think, oh, the 10-year should be at 5%. And the Fed has, with their Fed funds rate management and QE and whatnot, seen a 10-year around 1.5%. I'm of the view that 1.5 is not the natural rate if there was no Fed intervention, but that 5 is not the natural rate either. It's sort of an in-between view, largely because of Japanified conditions, secular growth challenges going forward, the amount of impact that future growth brought into the present by living above our means has created. Am I onto something in your view, or do you think that is more maybe just one of the potential causes in a whole bag of many?
I think it's one of the potential causes. And let me just step back and say, I think like you, I care about monetary policy. It's interesting, but I care more fundamentally about it. I think you share the same view because I want capitalism to flourish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to get to the place where we don't have to even have these conversations. Monetary policy is in the background. It's no one cares about it. And we worry about underlying structural issues. So I say that as I delve into this, I think the U.S. in particular is unique in this these demographics, these safe asset shortage challenges, because we are the largest provider of this type of debt to the world. And let me just throw a few things out there. If you look at the U.S.'s balance sheet to the world, so look at the private sector, the public sector, combine them, and it's the U.S. financial accounts, just we call the flow of funds. If you look at the liabilities that we owe to the world, a disproportionate share of them are short-term, liquid, relatively safe, fixed income type securities. Now, that includes treasuries, but also includes commercial paper, repo, bank accounts, currency. The world comes to us and they're begging us for these highly liquid dollar assets. And the number, if you look at the number, it's around 20 trillion. That's what's fixed income. If you throw equities in, it's close to 30 trillion in dollar assets that the world comes to us to hold. What's even more interesting is the demand for dollars is so strong that now these dollar liabilities are being created overseas. The BIS keeps track of this, and they show around 13 trillion and dollar liabilities created overseas. So there's this all-encompassing global dollar financial system, I think, has inertia. It's built in. And what it means for the U.S. and our economy is there's a demand for dollars that's probably going to be there, and that's going to continue to provide downward pressure on yields. It's going to keep the dollar overvalued. It's going to affect our trade balance. It has a lot of bearing what happens here, but I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon because there's this path dependency for a global dollar system.
So is high demand for dollar and dollar strength positively correlated then with the pricing of the bond market and therefore low yields?
I think generally, and not always, but generally, some of the demand for dollars can flow into to private firms offering other assets. But generally, yes, either they're going to buy, you know, private sector fixed income or the government's fixed income. And now maybe I'll take this other little more cynical view. I think 2008 and 2020 showed us that the Fed will backstop private sector fixed income markets. We saw the corporate bond facilities, but we also saw both times the money market fund facility, the commercial paper facility, primary dealer facility. So you could make an argument.
And high yield ETF purchases.
Yeah. So we broke new ground this last time.
Yeah.
But I think you can make the argument that even though these are privately provided, you know, fixed income securities, they effectively are backstopped like the GSEs if push comes to shove. So we could maybe point a finger at that as playing some role as well. That might lower their yields a little bit as well. We could go down a whole different conversation here. Is that a trade-off worth having? You know, would we have wanted to run on the global dollar system, or do we want to have this moral hazard created by the backstop? There's a trade-off there.
And so out of that trade-off, it seems to me both sides are very willing to ignore the other side trade-off. There is some moral hazard, right? There is some sure. impact to savers, retirees. And of course, the other side that Chairman Bernanke and others have articulated is what would have happened to savers in an economy that saw asset prices deteriorate is much worse. But I guess I wonder if you find that argument compelling. Are we are we begging the question? And I'm with you. The monetary policy becomes somewhat of a sideshow towards our ultimate goal of wanting markets to flourish, wanting the ultimate result of markets, of human flourishing, to take hold. Yep. And yet it does seem to me that heavy interventionist monetary policy requires us more and more to have to interact with that element of the economy as they increasingly financialize these components of capitalism, the components of a market economy.
Yes, I think you're right. I think there's no going back as well, though. I think we've gone down a path that the amount of disruption it would take to get back to a more pure system would be very, very disruptive. I'm not sure. We might say the libertarian instinct comes out. Yes, let's do it. Let's burn down things to the ground. But I really don't think people want to live through another Great Depression, something so severe. I would also note, again, it's hard to disentangle the benefits from the cost here. So Yes, the U.S. government through the Treasury and the Fed is effectively backstopping global dollar funding markets. I mean, we saw that with the Fannie repo facility, even the money market funds, the commercial paper, those ultimately help the entire global system survive these crises. But the flip side of that is the dollar is the dominant currency. As an American, I love that. But I also think it's been good for humanity. We talked about earlier how globalization has helped bring people out of poverty, you know, a billion people out of poverty in Asia. That required globalization. Would globalization been as strong without a global medium of exchange? I don't know. So there are, I think, also benefits it's easy to overlook as well. Again, it's a complicated, you know, cost-benefit consideration, but there are a lot of goods that have come out of the global dollar system and the government's backing of it, and there are some big costs as well that we may face down the road.
Do you believe that there is much to the conversations about long-term some of these forces changing as it pertains to China? China has an incentive to not allow us to continue to settle our current account deficit in our own currency, to not have the sort of leverage that we have in the trade deficit because we are the world's reserve currency. At some point, does the advantage you're referring to as causative in what's happening, does that advantage get arbitraged away and therefore change the playing field?
Eventually, it could happen, but it's really hard to see it at this point in time. I think China is shooting itself in the foot. The current leadership over there is turning back to more socialistic, inward-looking views on the economy. Moreover, even before him, though, China has had a strict, you know, capital controls. Not perfect, but you can't do that if you want your currency to become global. And this more generally, going back to a point I made earlier, China's institutions aren't trusted enough. They don't have that state capacity where global bond traders are willing to put their money there. And the rule of law isn't the same as it is in Europe and the US. You know, you can go to court if something happens. All bets are off if the Communist Party in China says, we're going to keep the money. So I think there's a long, long ways to go. And if anything, recent developments over there suggest they've extended that journey quite a bit.
So I started off talking about the present interest level in the Fed, the Fed's impact on inflation, the various causes that existed in 2021 in consumer price increases. There is most certainly a kind of universal acceptance right now that prices are much higher than they were a year ago. And you can have a lot of caveats in this discussion. The disproportionate impact of new and used cars. That's something we saw even in the CPI report that happened to come out on the day you and I are recording. There was base effect issues in the middle of 21. But I don't think there's any dispute at this point that for whatever reason, consumers face higher prices right now amidst a lot of supply disruption, labor shortage, et cetera. The thing I want to hone in on is whether or not you believe the Fed's balance sheet expansion post-COVID is part of the inflationary problem. I have been rather outspoken that I do not think so, other than maybe marginally, meaning asset prices, yes, consumer prices, no. Using the historical precedent of Japan, the historical precedent of our own QE 1 through 3, where doom and gloom predictions of hyperinflation did not come to be, was this time different? What did monetary policy in 2020 exacerbate price inflation in 2021?
I think it did, but more through the interest rate channel than the balance sheet channel. Like you, I don't think balance sheet had a lot of effect. I'm going to be careful. It has some effect. There's a signaling part to it, but I'm not a believer that the actual purchases themselves make that big of a difference in risk premiums. And going back to what you said earlier, I think they maybe would be where they are anyways, but there's this kind of academic idea debate about, is the Fed a special financial intermediary or not? Is the Fed doing something that would have been done by the marketplace or not? And I'm not sure that it is. And therefore, I don't think QE made that much difference other than to send a signal. I think going the other direction will be the same thing. I mean, one way to look at this, you know, the kind of the portfolio balance channel that's used to justify the Fed's QE, Bernanke invoked it, a lot of people invoke it. You know, the Fed goes out and buys treasuries, those investors then go buy mortgage-backed securities, those investors go buy something next level of risk, and you get this chain effect. And one of the stories is, the Fed's taking duration risk off the marketplace. It's taking the risk off private balance sheets and putting it onto the government's balance sheet, and that makes the world a better place. But when you think and you step back, that's not quite right. The Fed is moving risk off the private sector's balance sheet onto its own, but who ultimately owns the government? Who ultimately is behind the government? It's taxpayers, the private sector. So we really haven't changed risk. We've just maybe hidden it or put it in a different place. And so I'm not convinced that QE, outside of crisis moments, so like 2008, March 2020, I think, the Fed does make a big difference with its asset purchase. But in normal market functioning times, I'm not convinced it makes a big difference in terms of real activity. It's going to be the interest rate part that does the most.
So then even isolating that, post-GFC versus post-COVID, why did ZIRP have no inflationary impact post-crisis, but perhaps did have more of an inflationary impact post-COVID?
I think fiscal policy is the big difference. Fiscal policy is much more aggressive. The way I like to look at it, and you probably know this from Ramesh, I like to look at total dollar spending on the economy. That's my preferred approach to think about monetary policy. You can look at inflation. I like to look at total dollar spending. And if you look at least through third quarter, it looks like the dollar size of the economy is back where it would have been had there been no pandemic. Now, I think it's gone above that trend this quarter and probably, going into 2022. So I think the Fed, the Fed had some part to, the Fed could have hit the brakes a lot sooner. It didn't. It didn't do no harm with this new framework, but it had the tailwind of massive fiscal injection. And I think if I had to parse it out, I'd say 2020, I'm more sympathetic to what happened with fiscal policy. 2021, it's much harder to justify what happened in 2021. 2020 was literally putting a floor under the economy. If you're gonna forcibly shut down the economy, I think it's reasonable that you provide some kind of support to it. But 2021, some of the stimulus, I'm not sure it had much bang for the buck, and probably has led to some as well as unemployment benefits has led to some of this inflation we see now. I don't think it's the only thing. Like you, I think there's supply side angles to it. There's energy side angles to it. But there is a little bit of demand mixed in there as well. And I think moving forward, two things. One, I think the Fed will and is getting serious about inflation. Two, I believe global capitalism will do its part and bring down prices on supply chain issues as well as goods. One of the most interesting things we've seen is the price of goods shoot through the roof. Historically, or at least the past 25 years prior to the pandemic, they were on a deflationary trend. So I expect things to turn around maybe second half of this year moving forward. You need time, we need capitalism, and we need credible monetary policy.
And so getting the credible monetary policy back, getting time to go by and market incentives to solve for some of the supply and labor challenges creates at least a disinflationary reversal by the end of the year would be your forecast. I share that view there. But I'll ask you another question that comes up as a frequent criticism of high Fed intervention. I'm wondering if you share this one. Does the Fed being overly accommodative for a sustained period of time create zombie companies? Does it enable the flourishing of capitalism that you and I want to see, which includes the creative destruction process at times? Does it enable companies that shouldn't survive to survive, therefore misallocate capital and resources?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for that, but if I had to answer, I would fall back on, again, I think interest rates are largely where they would be even if there were no Fed intervention. So to the extent those zombie firms are relying on low financing costs, they would probably still have similar funding costs in the absence of the Fed.
And I guess I should have asked this earlier, David. You believe that even on the short end of the curve? I know we talked about it as it pertains to the 10 and 30 year, But you think that the natural Fed funds rate would be close to zero bound?
I don't think it'd be that low. I do think it's trending down. I think it's probably between zero and one on the short end. Yeah, I mean, I do going forward, and I just don't see it turning around soon anytime.
So they raise it to 150 through rate hikes. You think they'll be into a pretty egregious policy mistake?
Yeah, I will be surprised if they get three rate hikes this year. Now, I think they need to get close to that. I mean, I think that ultimately we need to end up there. But if you think of like, if you think 1.5% and you add in some term premium for the 10-year, that's just, you're putting it at a value that just the market itself doesn't see. If you look at like five-year forward on treasury yields, you know, it's struggling to get anywhere near that. So, you know, maybe the market's wrong. I mean, I want to be clear. Markets could be wrong. Consensus forecast could be wrong. Maybe we'll have a demographic turnaround. Who knows? But for the foreseeable future, I think the Fed and, you know, markets are really, you know, need some humility in what we can accomplish. But with that said, the Fed definitely needs to continue at least attempting and modestly moving forward and have the same humility that it demonstrated in 2019 when it went too far.
So what would you expect to see first? And I know we're this is conjecture. It's probably an unfair question, but given that outlook, would you expect to see $2 trillion come off the balance sheet before you see 150 Fed funds?
I think it's possible. I don't know, $2 trillion maybe too much, but I think it's definitely very possible. I mean, if you do a rate hike in March, it's only 25 basis points, another one maybe in June or September. You know, it sounds like they're going to start to run off in March. Taper will end by then. And, you know, everything that I've read suggests that the Fed's balance sheet, and even in the last FOMC minutes from December, the members noted that because their balance sheet is weighted so much to the short end, it's going to run off really quickly. In fact, I think Jay Powell mentioned this in his nomination hearings. It's going to be quicker and much larger runoff. So if they don't do anything, you could easily get a very large runoff within this year.
And so for listeners, what David's referring to is that a lot of people believe that when they stop quantitative easing, which is the buying of bonds with money that doesn't exist, that to tighten, they have to sell bonds that they had previously bought. And runoff refers to tightening by just simply not reinvesting the proceeds of matured bonds. They did that in 2017 and 2018, but it was really quite slow. Initially, only about $10 billion a month on a $4.5 trillion balance sheet at the time. But the point that you're making is that there's a greater amount of ultra short-term securities that if they truly were not reinvested, would naturally accelerate tightening without any actual selling of bonds into the marketplace.
Yeah. And again, the size of the balance sheet, $8.7 trillion, last I checked, that's so much larger, I think, than any estimate what's needed, even for this ample reserve system. So I think they could unwind quite a bit. It probably will go rapidly. As we discussed earlier, I don't think the balance sheet itself has that much of a bearing beyond signaling. So I think, you know, cross our fingers, if the economy continues to recover, Omicron's not a big deal. I think we could see some rapid changes in the size of the Fed's balance sheet. If I could speak to the Fed's balance sheet real quick, something else I think it's important to note about the Fed's balance sheet is this ample floor system, ample reserve system or floor system. And one of the defining characteristics is that it separates the size of the Fed's balance sheet from the interest rate. So the Fed could have a big balance sheet, a small balance sheet, and still have a particular interest rate target. Whereas pre-2008, it had to adjust the amount of, you know, reserves and buying and selling it did. And that's very consequential, I think, for political reasons. If the Fed's balance sheet can be expanded rapidly without causing inflation or without affecting, you know, the interest on reserves, the overnight rate, then it becomes an attractive piggy bank for any kind of political cause out there. And one of my bigger fears, probably more so than and what's the stance of policy this year is the politicization of the Fed. And I really do think we're seeing swings, you know, that it's going to swing really progressive and then, you know, might swing up to the other way dramatically, depending on who's in power. And I do worry that may create some volatility, some uncertainty moving forward.
Is the reason why you think that's more susceptible to happen now because it mirrors the national politics? It does seem to me that we went from Reagan and Bush to Clinton to Bush Jr. to Obama. You had pretty significant political changes in the White House and in the legislature. You had big shifts in the House of Representatives and the Senate going back and forth. And through all of that, the political elements of the Fed, from Greenspan to Bernanke to even Obama appointed Yellen, and there's been a lot of continuity at the Fed.
Yeah.
How has the Fed been immune from political volatility? And now you think it may not be immune from that?
And to be clear, I think there are a lot of people at the Fed who are worried about this. And I think even, you know, Chair Powell is as well. He's just being very guarded and has to be careful.
Yeah.
At the hearing, he gets attacked by the progressives for not doing enough. And then from the, you know, the far right, he gets attacked for doing too much. I think you're right. One factor is this increased politicization of our times. It's a reflection. It's, you know, the Fed's becoming more progressive, more woke. But I recently had a conversation with two ladies who took an interesting look at the research done by the 12 regional banks, and they documented the number of articles dedicated to inequality, to climate change, to some other progressive issues. And they show that it's becoming an increasing share of the Fed's research output at these regional banks. So it's definitely happening. It reflects the era we're in. But I would maybe add two other things. One that I had just mentioned was the fact that the Fed's balance sheet now, the size is independent from the stance of policy itself in terms of interest rates. It's going to be a target for green bonds, for maybe bonds to build the wall, depending on who's in power. And I think once this realization takes hold, hey, QE is this magic off-balance sheet tool we can use. Like my friend George Selgin calls it fiscal QE. Fiscal QE is whenever QE is used for reasons other than stabilizing, like the business cycle. It's for political things. So I think that second one, the fact that the Fed's balance sheet is more flexible now, it's going to be too tempting to ignore. And the final thing, and this is probably tied into all of them, is it's a generational thing. I think, you know, a lot of the younger millennials, people coming to power, people maybe even Congress, don't appreciate some of the challenges that, you know, the Fed went through in the past. So, you know, in fact, if we can use a historical analogy, go back to the Great Depression. After the Great Depression, there was people were very conservative, very austere. During the Great Depression, there was a lot of, you know, austere, very tight with fiscal policy. And then after the Great Depression, it swung to Keynesianism. I mean, very aggressive government. And then then it swung to, in the 1970s, and you got the more conservative approach. And I think what we're seeing now is a swing back in the other direction. I think it's just a generational development or pattern that is taking place. So I would put those three things down as important parts of the story.
Well, those are very good insights and really provocative to think about, because there are a lot of changing winds. And we're used, I think those of us that dialogue about this are used to thinking of it in purely economic terms, trying to project in the future certain things that we've seen from the past, what we expect from the Fed. And yet what you bring up there is the instrumentation of QE and what they like or don't like about it now being applied into a evolving environment in with woke circles or with other political objectives. It does invite some of that, and maybe some of even the MMT conversation, the idea that QE went the way it went, fiscal expansion post-COVID's gone the way it's gone, that then it invites a monetary element to the conversation where it can be used to rationalize completing a circle that fits a social or political agenda. It might be pretty naive of us to think that that wouldn't happen or couldn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I've been someone who was worried about, you know, the Fed not doing enough after 2008. But there's a part of me that worries that we might swing the other direction, you know, that it'll be pressured into doing too much and we may have to relearn some experiences from the past.
Well, I think some people might say that's putting it mildly. You know, I mean, I would argue that there are a lot of things that are not popular to talk about, particularly in a libertarian crowd. Yet through the complexity of it, we have to agree may be more complicated than a simple approach. Just one thing Ramesh does as well as anybody is break out what the real political consequences would be. I think Ramesh has convinced me that when those say that a big and interventionist Fed has created a larger government, Ramesh has pointed out that overly tight monetary policy has historically created a bigger government. And so this is a complicated subject, but I do think when you start talking about commercial mortgage-backed securities, not merely unplugging financial systems for dollar movement, for foreign currency swap, for even the protection of commercial paper and money market, when you talk about buying high-yield ETFs, when you talk about CMBS going onto the balance sheet, and paper trading from 50 cents on the dollar to par value, that's a dramatic intervention in private capital markets that I think we owe it to ourselves to at least question what the unintended consequences could be.
No, for sure. I think part of this, if I could add maybe a fourth factor I was thinking about as you were talking, one reason we're seeing this, what you've just outlined, as well as, you know, more progressive uses of the Fed and the potential uses of its balance sheet, is this zero lower bound environment. So if you can accept my original premise that there's these structural factors pushing rates down, and if you also accept that the traditional Fed tool is interest rate, you know, control of the short end of the curve, then the Fed's hands do get more tied on what it can do. Now, you could argue, well, why open up negative rates, but I don't think that's going to happen. So if fundamentals are keeping rates really low, if that means traditional Fed policy can't do what it normally does, then it's going to open up to more fiscal policy, number one, and or it may open up to the Fed having to buy other assets besides government securities. So, you know, talk about expanding the Fed's toolkit, you know, maybe buy negative rates or use negative rates, but also buy private securities. And, you know, other central banks have done this. You go over to Europe, they're already there. Japan, I forget, you probably know more than I do about this, but Japan at some point was the biggest buyer of ETF, corporate ETFs. So
still is. It was at one point about 70%, but it's still above 50% of their daily flow.
Yeah, so it's pretty remarkable what they have done and what could happen. Again, look at them. They're kind of the avant-garde of this, you know, what Larry Summers would call secular stagnation, but I would call this these demographic forces and structural forces pushing low rates down. What does it lead to when you have an aging population and everything else going on? And I wouldn't be surprised if we head down that path. I don't want to be there, but it may be where we end up.
Well, David, I really appreciate your time here. I think it would be really helpful for us to bring you back on later to kind of revisit some of these issues. We're all going to have a little more clarity on what Chairman Powell not just is signaling and talking about, but actually doing in a number of months. And maybe we could regroup to kind of update our own forecast and thoughts as he gets a little further in. I suspect that a lot of these things will go differently. You talked earlier about the markets are not a perfect predictor, and you're right, but I will say markets have been a better predictor than the Fed themselves has been about their own dot plotting of activity. And what I would expect is that you and I will both be right, that both of them will be wrong, that there will be something that goes off course a bit, and such is the nature of complicated monetary economics.
Yeah, I would like to come back. That'd be a great conversation.
Thanks so much for your time. And we look forward to having you back on the Capitol Record.
It was a delight. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation that I have enjoyed with Dr. Beckworth. David is very articulate. He has wonderfully thought through opinions. There were certainly some things said today that you may not agree with, or I may not even fully agree with, but I very much appreciate that diversity of opinion. I generally find a lot of what he says to be very comfortable. I think I probably would be a bit more concerned about the side effects of heavily interventionist monetary policy than it sounds like he would. But I also think his underlying view is one that I find indisputably true, that the natural rate of things is perhaps not as different as we may believe, given a lot of the factors that he talked about. And so those are things we're going to continue discussing future episodes. I will have David back on, and obviously the variety of opinions that exist on the topics of the Fed, of interest rate policy, of inflation. We'll keep hammering that out, but all with people of good faith, intellectuals who are serious about the cause of Capitol Record, even where there are differences of opinion in the details. And what is that cause? To defend the cause of a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to the Capitol Record.